My wife likes to get cheap books on Daedalus, so she got me this book, Chasing the Molecule by John Buckingham, which is a nice popular story about. You can also get it for $4.98, but $6.98 is hard to beat for a good book. This is a picture of the book. It's a popular book about discovering how bonds and such like in the 19th century. So if you want something to read, you could read that. Well, you're responsible for what we talk about, not that, but it's fun. And it's cheap. Okay, so oxygen and the chemical revolution began in 1789. So this was Yale chemistry class, 19-1S, Sheffield Scientific School. So about 100 years after the chemical revolution, 125. Okay, and you can see what they knew then. They knew obviously that CH4 was methane. They knew that you could react zinc with hydrogen, with sulfuric acid and get H2. They knew the structures of some organic molecules, although their conception of the benzene ring is a little different from what we have now. In fact, it's more similar to what the clairvoyant chemists saw than to what we draw now. Here's another one. And notice, one of the things we'll see in the old days is where our nomenclature came from. Notice here it's got alpha and beta as naming positions on that ring, and that kind of name is still used. Many of the things here you'll recognize. Here's the lab at that time. So they did distillations the way you do distillations. What's that thing down there on the right? Bunsen burner, right? Bunsen invented the burner around 1860 or something like that. There's another distilling flask. There's a mortar and pestle that's been around since ancient times. What's that? Thermometer. Not a thermometer. For doing titrations. What, remember what you call it?
A burette.
So that's something that's quantitative, right? These other things aren't measuring, they're just handling things. That's the only quantitative tool. And in fact, if we go back to their picture, you can see they brought along show and tells to have in their class picture, right? Things they were proud of or thought were funny or something. Do you see any quantitative tools in here? Yeah, there are burettes over there. Anything else? What's that? This? This? This, that's a big dish. They did things like they didn't do micro scale stuff then. No. Yeah. Yeah, there's a balance. Right, but it's not a high precision balance. The high precision balances were important then. They're beautiful instruments, but they weren't portable. You couldn't bring them down onto Prospect Street to take a picture. This is the building that's the computer science building now that you walk by on the way to get up here. That was the chemistry lab at that time. Okay, that's a very particularly important feature of the picture. That's C. Mail and Klein, who's the guy who, his name is on GlaxoSmithKline, the number 6 big pharma. And if you have Klein Biology Tower and Klein Chemistry Laboratory, that's from Klein, who was 19-1S. Okay, now here's something that's quantitative. What's quantitative about it? It's quartz crystals. Well, what can you measure about it that's quantitative? You could weigh it, of course, but we've already talked about balances. What else could you do? You could measure its refractivity, that's right. Yeah? You could do X-ray diffraction nowadays, find out where all the electrons are in the bonds and stuff, yeah. You could melt it, that's tough. Okay. But there's something that they could measure back then, even 100 years earlier than this. Will? Did you have something? Jordan?
Yeah, it's in a vacuum body by displacement.
Yeah, you could measure its density. But that's again sort of weighing. There's a more sophisticated thing you can do. They didn't do that back then, and it doesn't have very high conductivity. Conductivity came in the maybe 1850 or so. It became very popular around 1880.
Can you analyze how it cuts?
How it cuts. You could measure the angles between faces of a crystal. That turned out to be very important early on. Okay. In fact, if you look at the front of the building where you walked by, did you see this guy here? Who is it? Thomas Edison? No. It's Benjamin Silliman, the first real scientist at Yale, and he's got something in his hand. A big crystal. It's not quartz, but it's a big crystal. Okay. You know, almost always when you got portraits or statues of people, there's something there that they thought was important to include. Okay, and then you have these things along the front, and we talked about Boyle already and Boyle's law measuring the pressure and volume of gases. But now we're going to talk about, and he's the earliest person on our honor roll out there. And the next one is Lavoisier, who's more than 100 years later, right? So a long dry period there. Okay, but Lavoisier, Dalton, Avogadro, Davy, Gay-Lussac, Betzelius, Faraday, Wöhler, and Liebig. We won't talk about Graham, and we already talked about Bunsen just a little bit. Okay, but we're going to talk about these people and how they figured out this stuff about before X-ray, before scanning, probe microscopy, before quantum mechanics, how they figured out bonds and the structure of molecules. Okay, so you're related to all these people. These are all your cousins academically. Right, that did the figuring out. So there's you. People are placed on this according to their roughly to their date of birth, not to when they made their contribution, but to the date of birth. And then this column on the left shows various accomplishments, more or less entered according to their approximate date. Right. So there are things that are in boldface; those are experimental. That's the real thing. And there are things that are not in boldface, and those are concepts. Theories that developed, right? So we're going to go, for the next quarter of the semester, we're going to go through this and see how people figured things out. And you'll be interested in seeing how they're related to you. You're related through me, of course, since I'm teaching you. And I was taught quantum mechanics by E. Bright Wilson, right, who was very important in developing IR spectroscopy. And he was taught by, or was a postdoc with Linus Pauling at Caltech, who had the alpha helix of proteins, was due to Pauling and a lot of things. He's the guy that invented electronegativity that you love so much. Okay? And another postdoc with Pauling was Jack Dunnitz, whom you've heard a lot about already. And we've talked about these things over here, right, about a lot of stuff that happened in the 20th century. But another way you're related to the past is through my PhD advisor, Paul Bartlett at Harvard University, who was a physical organic chemist, as was his mentor, James Bryant Conant, who was the president of Harvard, who has two branches. The reason is he did his PhD with two people, one an organic chemist and one a physical chemist, and that's why you're getting taught so much physical stuff as well as organic in this course. Okay, so then if we connect this back into the previous century, you can see who all you're related to, all the way back to the chemical revolution, right? Which happened in, we could date it at 1789, as you'll see. And in particular, Lavoisier, who died childless, right? So he didn't have any biological children. He wasn't a university professor or anything like that, so he didn't actually teach someone, although he worked with people like Berthollet on the left. So, and certainly his tradition was the main tradition in France. Probably down to the present day, he's the main chemical hero in France. Okay, and just to mention once again, there's this bargain book that'll be available while the supplies last, I assume, if you're interested in it. Okay, but things didn't start with the chemical revolution. That's where people date modern chemistry from. But it built on a long tradition of arts and lore. For example, Here's a mosaic from Monreale in Sicily from the 12th century, and it shows something 2,000 years before that, which is, does anybody know what the story is here? Who is it?
Noah.
It's Noah, right? And you can see that he was a practical chemist, right? But he got in trouble for it, and his sons hid his shame, right? But notice on the right, there's actually a piece of apparatus that persisted. You know what that's called? A Florence flask. Why Florence? Because that's the kind of wine and oil, all olive oil, were shipped from Florence to England. And the flasks they came in were that kind of flask, and they were called Florence flasks. So a lot of this machinery that was used was ancient. Okay, that's 12th century, right? Okay, here's a bottle. So perfume was making chemistry. So here's a bottle that's a Roman, right? So that's even older than the Florence flask, right? So it's about 2,000 years old, and it's in front of the chemistry building when it was -5 days old before it opened, right? So a long tradition of chemistry. Okay, and we already talked about Francis Bacon, and this quote that I love so much that I'm going to use it a second time. All the philosophy of nature received is either the philosophy of the Grecians or of the alchemists, one gathered out of a few vulgar observations. That's the alchemists, or that's the Aristotelians, and the other out of a few experiments of a furnace. That's the alchemists. So the furnace was a big thing, to heat things to find out what they were. The one never faileth to multiply words, and the other ever faileth to multiply gold. So here's an alchemist working in his lab. And he's, you know, messing around, and he has a lot of this equipment. You see the mortar and pestle, for example, over there, flasks for distilling and so on. But the thing about alchemists in the main was that they kept their words secret. They kept their work secret. It was occult and hidden. Their goal wasn't to share it with other people in general. There was a display of the Beinecke Library has a wonderful collection of alchemical things, and they had a show this spring called The Book of Secrets, right, with a connection, obviously, to Harry Potter. But Newton did a lot more work in alchemy than he did in physics or with gravity, but you don't know that. Although you can go on a website at the University of Indiana and find a lot of his publications in alchemy. But the reason you don't know it is that they weren't published. Right? He wrote things, but he kept them secret so he wouldn't lose his job. And I always suspect that these people kept things secret to hide their ignorance, that they weren't really confident that they knew what they were talking about. So here's one of the things from this display last spring. This is a scroll that's roughly as big as this countertop here. It's a little narrower but longer, right? This is one panel from it. And it's the Visio Mystica of Arnold of Villanova. Here's Arnold of Villanova. He was in the 13th century, but this scroll is made in England in the 15th century. So he was a great authority. He was an expert in medicine. He was born in northern Spain. He was Catalan. He taught medicine for a long time in Montpellier, but he got in trouble with the church and went to Sicily, where that mosaic is from, which at that time, in the 12th, 13th century, was a real center of tolerance. Arabs, Jews, Normans, you know, from the north, the same people that went to France, they all collaborated together. It was a great flourishing of culture. Okay, so he's pointing to a book there. And now we could look at this page and see in the corners, here's air. And it says air, hot and moist. Right? And up in the top there is earth, cold and dry. And fire, hot and dry. And water, cold and moist, right? So these were the properties of the elements that were supposed to get mixed together according to the old-time alchemists. And then the more modern alchemists thought this wasn't it, or was only part of it, that you also had sulfur and mercury and salt, I think. Those were the three principles, and you could make everything out of these. And of course, this was all nonsense. But that didn't mean that people didn't study it, right? So here's a book on the Philosopher's Stone. right? And notice, it looks like people's organic textbooks, the people who are lucky enough to have textbooks, right? They underline every word. Right? There are 20 of these hands with a finger pointed to something very important. There are 15 nota bene signs in there. Right? Okay. And you'll see here that things about tinctures and elixirs, you know, the elixir is what will dissolve everything and so on. And then there are things like, as Rossi says, Morian says. It's all authorities, right, of what these old timers told you that you had to memorize and underline until you and put fingers on until you remembered it and believed it, right? Okay, then Paracelsus came along in the early 1500s with his new principles instead of the elements. But he had a lot of theories. One of them was the doctrine of sympathies, which is that in nature, if there's a poison, you'll find the antidote someplace nearby. This is a principle. For example, that. What's that? Poison ivy. But where poison ivy grows, you often find nearby jewelweed. And jewelweed is said to be an antidote for poison ivy. Okay? Now, in fact, this was tested in a double-blind test at the University of Penn State University in 1997. And they found it was no better than water. They took 10 people, put the poison on them, and on two places on them, the poison ivy poison. Then on one of them, double blind, they put jewel weed, and on the other they put water. There was no difference. Okay, that's the stuff that's in poison ivy. It turns out that there are several versions of it in poison ivy. That one, only somewhat less than half of the population gets a reaction from. But if you have double bonds in it, and in particular if you have two double bonds in it, or three, or that three, all those things are in poison ivy, but the one with two double bonds, more than 90% of the people are allergic to. So you might have thought that the functional group here is up in the OH, or in fact it's more than OH. It's an enol, right? It's an enol. In fact, it's a phenol, which is not one of the functional groups you have to know now, the benzene and an OH. So those are functional groups you recognize. The double bonds are functional groups. You don't think of them being such important functional groups, but they obviously are in poison ivy. Okay, so these functional groups you're working on are important, even the less striking ones. Now, here's willow. The Latin name for it is salix. And it's found in swamps where people get malaria. And in the bark of the willow, there's this thing called a glycoside, which is called salicin because it comes from salix. And if you hydrolyze that to make it into an OH, and oxidize that to make it in COOH, you know what you got? Right, you got this, salicylic acid. So in fact, the doctrine of sympathies works sometimes. Right, near the poison, the malaria, you find willow trees, yeah. What? No, not, well, it reduces fevers. Right? Okay, so here's a book that someone wrote for himself, his notes on reading the literature. It's called a Vade Mecum. So it's like an alchemical lab manual that was on display from 1557. And you can see that he's showing these instruments that people use, like for filtering, for fire, distillation. Right? These are certain things that were important when chemistry developed. And notice what it says up on the top. What's that refer to? Arnold of Villanueva, right? The guy from the 13th century. Still got your authorities. Okay, now here, this looks like an alchemical lab, but it isn't. It's actually a chemical lab. And this is the lab that is on the frontispiece of the book about air and fire by Carl Wilhelm Scheele in Sweden, who was a pharmacist. He came just before 1789, as you can see. He died at the age of 44, and he made a lot of important discoveries. There's a postage stamp that honored him from Sweden. Unfortunately, it's not his picture. No one knows whose picture it is. There is no authentic picture of Scheele. But he's the first person that purified organic acids, got pure crystalline samples of salts of the acids, like lactic acid. Where did that come from? His accomplishment was to purify these things and isolate them, right? You've been doing purifications in lab, right? Okay, so where do you think he got lactic acid from? Right, sour milk. Okay, or and here's his paper about it on milk and its acid, right? Published in 1780. So he purified them as salts, right, which he could crystallize. So he had to work to get them. So these are some translations of some passages from that paper. Okay, you tried bismuth, cobalt, antimony, tin, mercury, silver, and gold. They were attacked by lactic acid, he said, either by digestion or by boiling. After standing over tin, the acid caused a black precipitate to form in a solution of gold in aqua regia. Okay, or another experiment, iron and zinc were dissolved with formation of flammable air. What's that? H2, right? That's what was on the building, the computer science building there. The iron solution was brown and gave no crystallization, but the zinc solution crystallized. Bingo! That meant you could get it pure. So he got a pure sample of lactic acid for the first time. With copper, our solution first took on a blue color, then green, finally dark blue, but it didn't crystallize. Lead dissolved after several days of digestion. The solution acquired a sweet, tart taste, but did not crystallize, right? So the payoff was the zinc, where he got crystals, right, and was therefore able to purify it. He died at 44, right? Okay, he did citric acid. Where did he get that? From lemons, of course. He did uric acid. Okay. He did tartaric acid. You know where that comes from? It comes from tartar, which is the lining that forms in wine casks. So you see it sometimes on the corks of wine bottles on the inside. Benzoic acid. That's from gum benzoin. Okay. And oxalic acid. You know where that comes from? From rhubarb. So why call it oxalic? Okay, oxy is a root meaning sharp. Now, what's sharp about rhubarb? Well, oxy, you know words with oxy, like oxymoron, right? But why? What's an oxymoron? An oxymoron is, oxy means sharp, and moron means dull. So an oxymoron is a sharp dullness. It's something that contradicts itself. Okay? Okay, so what's sharp about rhubarb? It's taste, right? It has an acidic taste. In fact, Latin acidus, it means the same thing as Greek oxus, which is sharp, right? It comes from to be sour, and the root ak means sharp or ox. So oxy means sharp. Okay, so that's why it came from rhubarb. Now, what made these things sharp? You guys are experts in functional groups. Ah, they're carboxylic acids. Almost all are carboxylic acids. But and why is carboxylic acid? Acid, we went through this last time. I won't dwell on it now, but you'll remember that you get a more stabilized anion. Both the starting material and the product, the anion, are stabilized, but the anion is more stabilized because it has a higher HOMO. So whereas the alcohol has a pKa of 16, the carboxylic acid has a pKa of about 5. Because it depends on the difference in energy between these two, and if you stabilize the anion more than the starting material, you favor it at equilibrium. Okay. There'll be a little bit more to the story than just the fact that you have that HOMO-LUMO interaction, but we'll talk about that later. Okay, now we notice that uric acid doesn't do the trick. Let's try analyzing the functional group in uric acid. Okay, so here's the starting material, here's the anion. But we can draw the anion in two different additional resonance structures beyond the first one, right? Or we can draw the starting material in two. So the starting material should be particularly stable, right? Because it's got several resonance structures, or several HOMO. LUMO interactions. This HOMO with this LUMO, this HOMO with this LUMO. They overlap well across a single bond in a pi way. Right? So that should make this stable. But if stabilizing the starting material is not going to help out. What helps out? If you lose that proton that's on the nitrogen, right, then you have a really high HOMO to stabilize, and now you get ever so much more, so the pKa is as good as that of a, almost as good as that of a carboxylic acid. Whereas the pKa of a normal amine is 38, 20 powers of 10 less than an alcohol even. Right? But this really does the trick in the HOMO-LUMO world. Okay, now Shayla not only isolated pure things, pure organic compounds, he also discovered elements. In fact, I think he's the one that has a record for the number of elements discovered. All these, and he named some of them. For example, tungsten is from Swedish. It's tungsten, which means heavy stone, right? Because it's very dense. It's far down the periodic table. Okay? By contrast, these are gases. And that's how chemistry really got organized logically, was by studying gases. They had Boyle's Law. And what's great about gases? I mean, in many ways, they're, of course, inconvenient. You can't hold them in your hand and so on. And so what's good about gases? They're easy to purify, right? Of course, you have to separate one gas from another, but there are not nearly as many gases as there are solid or liquid things that are mixed together. So they're very easy to purify. Okay, and so Shayla discovered these. For example, in 1771, he did this experiment by heating silver carbonate, and it got lighter because he drove off CO2 and got silver oxide. And if he heated the heck out of that, greater than 340 Celsius, then he got pure silver, but a gas, and that gas was, we now know, as O2. He called it fire air. Right? That's what this book was about, that picture of his lab was the frontispiece of the book. Okay? And he wrote a letter here in 1774. He wrote it in French, although he spoke German, naturally. And he had help, so he had to make a lot of corrections here. This is the draft, but he actually sent it, fine copy went to Paris, and it said, "Since I have no large burning glass, I beg you to try with yours." What did he want to do with the burning glass? He wanted to do this formation of oxygen, according to the stuff he tells about here. Right, and he wanted to do it inside something rather than to put it in a furnace and heat it up. Okay, so that would have been much more convenient. But he had to find someone that had a big burning glass to focus the sun's light. And here was what they had in Paris, a big burning glass. Right, and who was it that had it in Paris? Do you know? Lavoisier. So he wrote this letter to Lavoisier, but Lavoisier never wrote back. Right? But Lavoisier invented oxygen about 5 or 6 years later, discovered oxygen. Okay? And Priestley, too, a little bit before Lavoisier. And Buckingham doesn't have a whole lot of use for Lavoisier, so he talks about this a little bit, too, I noticed. Okay, so there's Lavoisier. But he's really a hero, despite his having some personal failings. Okay, so 1789, we said we'd date the chemical revolution. Is this the chemical revolution? This is the tennis court oath at the beginning of the French Revolution. These were exactly simultaneous, right? There was only one guy who's not voting, who voted against this. It's the guy right here. Most of those guys are lawyers, incidentally. Okay, now, these people were radicals, or considered radicals. That comes from an Indo-European root which is constructed as werod, from which a lot of interesting words come, all meaning root. For example, Wurzel means root in German. Or wort, like St. John's wort, means a root. Or licorice is glucosoriza from Greek, which means a sweet root. Or race, razza in Italian, comes from that. Or rutabaga, right? Or radix in Latin comes from the same root. And that's where you get radish from, which is a root, of course. But also eradicate. You know what that means? Eradicate? What's the sense of it? To pull it up by the roots, right? That's the end of that. Okay, or radical is the word we're interested in, which means going to the root or origin, the very ultimate source of something. For example, in mathematics, they used radicals. That word was applied in the 16th century. In what sense is a square root or radical of a number? Because it's the source which multiplied with it, by itself gives the number you're interested in. So it's the root of your number. Okay, or in politics, we have radicals, people that go back and want to revise everything from the very beginning. Or in chemistry in 18th century France, radical was used in ways we'll see. Okay, so it was, here's the, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, the first citation they have for the use of the word radical in English. And of course, this in 1787 would be considered a radical document. But in the same year, 1787, these French scientists got together and published this book. Guiton de Morveau is the principal author, about nomenclature in chemistry. You can come and look at it afterwards. It's a method of chemical notation. Okay, this is an English translation, which I don't know what the date is. This is from 1808, but it was 1787, the original French. Okay, so there's Guiton de Morveau. He was 50 years old, but he didn't do this alone. He worked with Berthollet and Fourcroy, who were 39 and 32, and with Lavoisier. Has anybody seen this picture? Where? It's in the Metropolitan in New York, right? And this, here he was 45 years old with his wife, whom he married when she was 13, incidentally, and he was in his early 20s. They paid £7,000 to David, the famous painter, to paint this portrait, which is the equivalent of about $300,000 now, depending on how you translate the value of money. So they were well-to-do, right? Now, but here again, they're getting their portrait painted for a fancy price. They want to show important things in the painting. So what's he doing? Yeah? He's writing. He's writing a book. He's writing the Traité élémentaire de chimie, which is this book here. This is a copy. It's not the original. Okay? So that's what was published in 1789. Okay? But there are other things being shown as well. This is a page. One of the neat things about this book, there are lots of neat things about it, but at the end of the second volume, there are a whole bunch of fold-out pictures. Right, that show, as opposed to occult chemists who tried to hide everything, here they show exactly what equipment they had and how they used it. And some of it, let's see, number five, like this one here. All right, and we're going to go through and see how this one worked. Right, or this one here, which is the one, this panel here is what's shown on the right. Okay. Now, notice that things from that panel are in this painting, right? For example, that bell jar is in the painting, and this so-called eudiometer with mercury coming up in it, or that big 16-pint balloon down there with metal fittings on it, right? Or there's a screw thing that goes on the end of it, right? And notice down in the bottom of here, it says Paul's Lavoisier sculpsite. That means it was drawn by Paul's Lavoisier, that's Madame Lavoisier, his wife, who studied painting and drawing with David in order to be able to draw these things for the notebook. She also painted, and that's her portfolio in the corner of things for this book. So this book was what they were really focusing their life on at that time. Okay, and there's a painting she made of one of their friends. Who's that? Right. Okay, now here's the whole thing. And this device is for weighing a gas, because the main technique Lavoisier used was weighing things. And gases, as I said, were going to be key. So he had to be able to weigh a gas. So how do you do it? The web page leads you through this, but let me just show you quickly. So first you have to generate a gas and collect it. So they have a bell jar filled with mercury there in this basin, and they heat G, and it starts bubbling up through the mercury and displaces the mercury. Have you guys done this kind of thing? With water, not with mercury. Yeah. Okay, so you got the gas collected in the bell jar A there. Okay, but you can do the same thing with this enormous bell jar. Remember, that thing up at the top is that thing that's down at his feet. It's about that big around. Okay, so he fills that up all up. Well, he doesn't fill it with mercury. He evacuates it because he's got a vacuum pump. Robert Hooke, 130 years before, had built a good vacuum pump, remember, to do Boyle's Law stuff. Okay, so they've got it all connected together, and that's all evacuated. And the bottom thing is filled with mercury and put in a basin, and you generate gas, and it bubbles up and fills that container at the bottom with whatever gas you're interested in. Okay, then you turn the valves, and now it'll suck the gas up into the top. Okay, and then you close, when you get a certain amount up, you close the valves. And now that height of the mercury measures the difference in pressure between whatever's in the bulb and atmospheric pressure. So you know what the volume is because you fill that thing with water and weigh it. And you know, and now you can take it apart. You can take it apart and there by unscrewing that and go and weigh it, and you've weighed the gas, and you know what it would be at atmospheric pressure just from Boyle's Law by multiplying. Okay, so we can weigh a gas. That's pretty good. Here, Lavoisier working at his pneumatic trough doing this kind of thing. So this trough is full of mercury, and over here on the right is Madame Lavoisier taking his dictation as he does his experiments. And in fact, he couldn't speak English, so the only way he could correspond with Priestley was by Madame doing the writing and the reading. Okay, and she drew this picture of him working. Now, he's working with these big things of mercury. Sharif, here you're in front. Have you ever lifted mercury? Okay, here's a jar of mercury. Just hold it over this.
Oh, wow.
He says, oh, wow. How many of you have lifted that much mercury before? Nobody. People are so afraid of, and properly afraid of mercury. We got it over this basin so that if it breaks. But after class, come and lift it. You'll say, wow. I guarantee you'll say, wow, the way Sharif did. So he had some biceps on him to do this. Okay, because that's a big thing of mercury, right? Sharif?
Yeah.
Okay, and in fact, much of Lavoisier's equipment still survives in the Musée des Arts et Métiers in Paris. And here you can see is this thing that the trough you'd fill with mercury, it would fill this thing with mercury, bubble up, connect your bulb up at the top, and so on. Okay. See, he was so well-to-do, he could pay people to make all these things. Not many people could do that. So this is the book, the first page of the Traité élémentaire de chimie. And it says, presented in a new order and according to modern discoveries with figures, right? That's Madame's work. 1789, the same year as the French Revolution began. And notice he's a member of all sorts of scientific academies, including Philadelphia. Why? Because that's Benjamin Franklin's hometown, right? He got his friend in. Okay, this is the beginning. This is a wonderful thing to read. I advise you to read it either in French or it's translated, of course. Let's translate it. I had no other object when I began the following work than to extend and explain more fully a memoir I read at the public meeting of the Academy of Science in 1787 on the necessity of reforming and completing the nomenclature of chemistry. All he wanted to do was to make the words better. Right? That was his goal. And he completely started a revolution in chemistry. While engaged in this employment, I perceived, better than I had ever done before, the justice of the following maxims of the Abbé de Condillac in his Systems of Logic and some of his other works. So this is a quote from Condillac. We think only through the medium of words. Languages are analytical methods. Algebra, which is adapted to its purpose in every species of expression, in the most simple and most exact and best manner possible, is at the same time a language and an analytical method. The art of reasoning is nothing more than a language well arranged. So you can just give things arbitrary names and put them in bottles on shelves. But if you try to give good names to them, then you have to organize your thinking. Okay? Thus, while I thought myself employed only in forming a nomenclature, and while I proposed to myself nothing more than to improve the chemical language, my work transformed itself by degrees, without my being able to prevent it, into a treatise upon the elements of chemistry. So people always say, oh, do we have to learn the nomenclature? That really is where it all started, right? Was by trying to get a good nomenclature. The impossibility of separating the nomenclature of a science from the science itself is owing to this. That every branch of physical science must consist of three things: a series of facts, which are the objects of the science, the ideas which represent these facts, and the words by which these ideas are expressed. Like three impressions of the same seal, the word ought to produce the idea, and the idea to be a picture of the fact. So three impressions of the same seal, you know, like a wax seal. Okay? And as ideas are preserved and communicated by means of words, it necessarily follows that we cannot improve the language of any science without at the same time improving the science itself. Neither can we, on the other hand, improve a science without improving the language or nomenclature which belongs to it. However certain the facts of any science may be, and however just the ideas we may have formed of these facts, we can only communicate false impressions to others while we want words by which these may be properly expressed. Right? So one of the reasons we're focusing on this development in the 19th century is to see where the words we used came from. So the thing that, as I was talking to Professor Moore about this yesterday, who's read Lavoisier, and he said that the amazing thing is you pick up that book and you read it and you say, yeah, I understand what he's talking. If you read any other book from before this time, or most books after it, you say, what the heck is he talking about, you know? But Lavoisier is so clear, you can understand exactly what he's talking about. Okay, so the facts and the ideas and the words, and they've got to all be tied together as impressions of the same seal. Okay, so this is the beginning of the first volume, and he says it's going to be in a new order, chemistry, not presented the way it used to be presented. I have a book that was published not long after this, which is just a compendium. It's in three volumes. It's about this big. And it's just garbage. I mean, it's just, actually, the very last page of it talks about Middletown, Connecticut, things they got in mines out of Middletown, Connecticut. But it's just a catalog of things. It tells you nothing. Okay? So there's the doctrine. That's the theory, right? The nomenclature. And the operations, how to do the experiments, right? So that's where his wife helped out so much in. So it begins with the doctrine and then goes to nomenclature, but they're all tied together. So one of the key ideas is of elements. He says, if by the name of elements we mean to designate the simple indivisible molecules, molecule means little thing, right? The indivisible molecules that make up substances, it is probable we do not know what they are. Right? But if, on the contrary, we associate the name of elements or principles of substances, the idea of the furthest stage to which analysis can reach, all substances that we have so far found no means to decompose are elements for us. Now, here's the periodic table of the elements. Are they elements according to Lavoisier or not? Why not? Mayrov? Right, there are electrons in there, there are nuclei. If you go in the nuclei, there are protons and neutrons. If you go into them, there are quarks and so on. So we know a lot more now than Lavoisier knew. But at that time, they couldn't take things apart any further. Right, so those were the elements, the things that you can't take apart. They behave with respect to us like simple substances. So that's what he's going to... It's an operational definition of elements. So here's a table of simple substances, these elements. Okay, this is an English translation done by Carr in Edinburgh, which was done just like 2 years after the book was written, maybe 1 year. Okay, so he's got a list of the elements. What's the first element? Light, and the second is heat or caloric. These he calls imponderable. Is that because you can't think about them? Why? What's imponderable mean? You can't weigh them. But he figured out a way to weigh them. He still calls them imponderable because they're obviously so different from these others. He couldn't weigh them. Sorry, he could weigh oxygen, he could weigh nitrogen, he could weigh hydrogen, but he couldn't weigh heat and light. Sorry, I said misspoke, as they say. Okay, now, but you could measure them even if you couldn't weigh them. So if you want to measure caloric, what do you measure it with? A calorimeter. And this is his calorimeter, built by Laplace, his young collaborator, the same guy who did the Laplacian, which is that del that you use for quantum mechanics, right? The second derivatives, that's Laplace. But he was practical too and built this calorimeter, which you see there's a scale here. That's 3 feet. So this is a big thing. It stands up this high off the bench, right? Okay, now what is it? There's a lamp. What you're interested in is how much heat there is in oil. So how are you going to find out how much heat there is in oil? Take it out by burning it, right? Measure it. Okay, so you're going to burn it with a lamp. Okay, so you put the lamp in that bucket, put the bucket in that cage and put the lid on. Then you put the cage inside this big can. Okay, and put that big lid on, the thing that's right in the middle of the picture. Okay, now, so you now got a flame that's going to burn inside this can. Okay, how are you going to measure how much heat gets out? You're going to use it to melt ice and see how much water you get. Okay, so the flame is completely surrounded. No heat's going to escape, right? Because it's got ice all around it, outside the cage, right, in that blue area, but also in the lid above it, right? So there's no opening out to outside, except there's a little tiny, hole here. Why do you need this little tiny tube? You have to be able to get oxygen in to keep the flame going, but just a little bit. And it goes through the ice, so the air that comes in is cooled, right? And the air that goes out gets cooled, so you're not exchanging any heat with outside. Okay. Now notice that this thing has ice in it, so that's surrounding the flame. But the lid is on top of this, so when it goes through here, that it's going to be melting ice, but it's not melting this ice. It's melting ice that's in here, right? So it's really good, except for what? What's going to be the problem? Where else is heat coming from to melt ice? From outside. So what's neat about the design? Jordan?
Double-walled.
It's double-walled. So he puts ice in there too, and on top. So no heat will come in from the outside, only from the flame. Right? And now you start the thing up, and you're going to melt and collect water. Okay? And at the end of the experiment, you put that thing underneath, open the tap, and then weigh the water, and that's proportional then to how much heat. So it's a calorimeter to measure the amount of the element caloric. Okay, and here's a picture of that actual device which still exists there. Okay, now the facts come from analysis. What time is it? Oh, it's time to quit here. Oh, now I'm going to lecture again on Friday, as you'll not be surprised to hear. We have an exam on Monday. I'm going to include on the exam as fair game anything that was in today's lecture, even the couple frames I didn't get to. Okay, but not the other stuff that's on Friday. There'll be wikis on the stuff that's on Friday, but they're not due until after the exam. Okay, so the stuff that's new, there'll be a couple frames at the beginning from this lecture, but the stuff that's new on Friday will not be on the exam, and you won't have to do those wikis until the Tuesday after the exam before the next lecture. Okay, and we have a review session tonight, 8 to 10 in WLH, I think it's 207, it's on the website. Oh, and if you want to feel Mercury, this is your opportunity. It's only somebody like me that would let you do that. So hold it over this. Pick it up like this. Here.
What? Oh, my God.
No, don't hold it way up. We don't want to drop it.
No way.
Okay, not too high, just put it down.
I forgot to mention, last week...
Careful with it, yeah.
At the beginning of the week, I checked the wikis, and I was assigned for Friday, and then when I went over the weekend to do my Friday wiki, I saw it was moved to Wednesday. So I apologize for that.
Okay.
Professor,
oh, jeez. It looks so much like water.
Is mercury itself not particularly absorbent?
See, where is that? Yeah. One hand.
Hey.
Yeah.
Sorry, may I ask about the hybridization of ethers again? Like,
yeah.
How do we know which one is going to have more S character, the lone pairs of electrons or the bonds?
It's probably the lone pairs of electrons.
Okay. So,
but this is not a big deal, really.
Yeah. All right. And how does that determine, like, whether it has a high valence?
Well, the OH bond and the CH bond are lower lumos than our point of comparison, CC and CH. That's clear. But you have to get overlap, too, to do it.
Yeah.
Right? So it's much easier to overlap with hydrogen than it is with carbon.
Wow.
So the OH...
But for ethers.
Like that, Renji?
Yeah.
I know.
How does that work? It's concave up?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's more cohesive.
Wait, I'm going to try lifting it.
Professor.
Yeah.
My name's Andrew Kramer. I'm a pre-freshman.
Oh, good.
Looking at your school.
Thank
you for letting me sit in here.
Sure,
wait,
no trouble.
Why are all those drops on us?
I got to keep an eye on these guys, make sure they don't run away with it.
That's cool.
Yeah, we'll see you.
Professor McBride.
That's very surprising. Huh. Is it...
No, don't let it run out. It's hard. It goes all over the place. If you, yeah, don't tip it.
Oh, it beads up, right?
Yeah.
It beads up?
Yeah.
Professor?
Oh, it's heavier, like, if you lift it like this.
Yeah.
You can be very difficult.
Oh, yeah.
The lens.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So it's 8 to 10.
Yeah. Surprise you?
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing. You can have 30 people lined up and everyone is surprised.
Oh my gosh. Even after watching people pick it up, it's heavier than you think.
I never actually picked up that much.
That's...
Yeah. I've always wanted to make a mercury barometer.
Yeah?
You can buy them.
Surprising, isn't it?
Yeah. Certainly denser than water. I've held a lot of lead before.
Uh-huh.
Pour, my dad makes little boats.
Chunk of lead.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Pour it into the keel of a boat.
Yeah, sure.
And so we would melt down large quantities of lead.
Oh, I was wondering where my Roman glass went, but it's right there.
My dad said that when he was working in a boat shop, they ended up they're pouring lead for a keel, and they spill probably 4,000 pounds of lead because the mold broke.
Oh, wow.
Ran across the floor.
Wow. Really? Where is this?
This is in a boat shop.
But where?
In Oregon.
Oregon? Yeah, wow.
It must have been fun to clean up.
Just a second, I want to quit this.
They're like, they're pouring it on the keel on the ground, right? Well, molten lead all of a sudden is like racing across the floor. So they had to like jump to high ground. It's like that.
Yeah, right.
We were working with the amine, and we thought it was both a HOMO and a LUMO, but
amine or imine?
Imine.
Uh-huh.